When you play the MP3, the first 15 seconds is sort of blank because it's me getting my computer ready to go. I didn't mean to do that. So when you go to do that, when you go to run one of those, remember, you know, you got to let it play for about 15 or 20 seconds before I get going. Not the right thing to do here. Everybody's here, maybe? 3, 6, 9, oh, almost everybody. So we'll get going, get really started, for real. We talked about membrane electrodes last time, and the most important membrane electrode was the glass membrane electrode. I'm going to talk about a few others a little bit in a few minutes here. Let's see. So I will be discussing these other ones. I don't know. I probably won't cover all of them. We talked a little bit about that glass membrane and the two different solutions. I showed you an electrode, a glass pH electrode, and we came up with this equation, which is sort of programmed into your meters. And I do have some electrodes here. And so we talked about how this all works, and how to get some pH measurements correctly. We even got to the point, I think I have them probably on here, concerning errors in pH measurement. So we talked a little bit about that. We talked about calibration, proper calibration of a pH electrode, and using the pH 7 buffer first because of the ISO potential built into the meters. And let's see, what else did we talk about? And then, of course, use another pH and set the slope. We showed a slide like this that showed electrochemical shorthand down here at the bottom for an electrochemical cell, such as a pH cell, but you could write one for electrochemical shorthand for any of this stuff. And then I went through some things about error in pH measurements. And this is just a bunch of topics regarding pH that I wanted to cover kind of quickly. One of them, of course, is the whole issue of accuracy and precision. And typically, we're really dealing in this area, as far as accuracy is concerned, unless you do some really extreme, take some extreme measures. I don't know if I described the Faraday cage, but in order to prevent electrical interference, you basically put a wire cage around your instrument and ground that so that it doesn't pick up electrical interference. That's one type of interference or error that can be a problem. You also have to have very accurate temperature control, and then, as I mentioned, you need to use specialized buffers that are actually known to the thousandth place if you want to do these really high accuracy measurements. Normally, our accuracy is right here, okay? Hundredths, plus or minus one in the hundredths place. We can use the thousandths place if we want to get precision. We want to know, okay, I need to know where I am. I need to know if the measurement is drifting, if I'm right where I was when I made the last measurement, but my accuracy is still going to be limited by the buffers. We mentioned junction potential and how the junction potential is a something that's a non-ideal potential that's present. We don't actually measure it. We don't actually eliminate it. We try to minimize it by matching the ionic strength of calibration buffers and test solution. We don't always do that. Sometimes people do it. Sometimes people are a little bit more careful about it than others. Maybe you probably said, I never bother. Well, yeah, if you're not concerned about super accuracy down to the, down to this level, then maybe it's not important to you. But normally we compensate for it in our measurement system by trying to set up a ionic strength in our buffers and our test solutions that are similar, and therefore it's taken into account in the measurement that we make. I mentioned the asymmetry potential, another non-ideal potential present just because there's strain in the glass membrane, that little glass membrane when it was formed, and annealed in an annealing oven right down the hall here. We have a glass blowing lab, and they have an annealing oven. And when you know, if you've ever done anything with glass, you know, heat it up over the Bunsen burner and then let it cool, and it cracks, you know. Or you take the glass and you dip it in cold water, that'll definitely crack it. Okay, so the idea is you have to allow the glass to cool slowly. Okay, allow the molecules in this substance, which is not crystalline, but is an amorphous glass, allow those molecules to cool slowly, so there's less strain in that material. Well, presumably it's strain in the glass that creates this problem with the asymmetry potential, and there is a not the exact same potential across the membrane, on either side of the membrane, even when there's identical solutions. So again, something that is built into the measurements that we can't do very much about, but we need to know that it's there. I mentioned some information about the temperature, and when we're using electrodes or doing calibration, we need to be concerned about the temperature, because temperature is part of the Nernst equation. And so if our buffers that we're using for standards and our test solution are not at the same temperature, we will have an error. Or if there's changing temperature, or if over time my solution is warming up to room temperature, it's going to drift. My measurement's going to drift, and you're going to think it's the meter. It's never the meter. Okay, it's never the meter. When you're making a pH measurement or any kind of an ion selective electrode measurement, it's not the meter is usually not the problem. It's usually the electrodes that are the problem. It's usually something to do with the reference electrode, more often than not. If you're making pH measurements or measurements with something like a solid-state ion-selective electrode, they're such simple devices that, generally speaking, the reference electrode is the thing that gives you the most difficulty. And then you have, I mentioned here, automatic temperature compensation probes, some built into the electrodes. Some electrodes, like a Ross electrode, have a very low temperature coefficient, and therefore, because if the temperature coefficient is very low, that means that slight changes in temperature are not going to affect the measurement, and therefore you're a little bit better off with an expensive electrode like that. Okay, I don't think I talked about everything else, and I'm up to alkaline and sodium error, and I didn't talk about this, did I? You guys are just here, right? You don't. I'm just the guy up front that goes wah 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 wah. Okay. All right. So when you make a pH measurement, if you make a pH measurement at very high pH, and that's what all these words on the slide. Okay. Oh, look at all those words. Well, you can read that in your spare time. All right. Watch me. Okay. I might do something funny. So if you make a pH measurement at a very high pH, how do you get high pH? Yeah, you dump sodium hydroxide into the solution, right? So if I were to want to make a pH measurement at up around pH 12, and I got the pH 12 by adding base to the solution, that means that since I wanted to add hydroxide to the solution, I had to add some other ion. It's hydroxide's an anion, and it needs a cation for electroneutrality. So I added sodium hydroxide or potassium hydroxide or something like that. And so in the solution, besides the fact that my electrode, my little pH electrode, responds to hydrogen ion, okay, remember what that is. pH is the negative log of the hydrogen ion activity. So the electrode is responding to that. If the pH is 12, as it says on this slide, then the hydrogen ion activity is 10 to the minus 12th molar. Wow, that's a small number. Okay? So the hydrogen ions that this electrode would be responding to, very small number, very low concentration, very low activity. But the solution has a lot of sodium in it. And I dumped a lot of sodium hydroxide in the solution in order to get the pH up to 12. So maybe at pH 12, my sodium concentration is something like 0.01 molar sodium. So I've got 10 to the minus 2 molar sodium to get enough sodium hydroxide in there to get the pH up to 12. And I've got 10 to the minus 12th molar hydrogen ion. Okay, H plus. So there's just 10 orders of magnitude difference between those two ions, okay? 10 orders of magnitude. What's that? 10 billion? Okay, so the sodium concentration is 10 billion times the hydrogen ion concentration. And we're expecting our little electrode to measure that. Well, there's a problem. The electrode gets so swamped by sodium, it begins to respond to this other cation, sodium, where it normally was designed, constructed, and we want it to measure the other cation, hydrogen ion, H+, okay, or hydronium ion, or whatever you want to call it. So we have a problem. The electrode begins to respond to these other ions, to, in this case, sodium. And when, therefore, at pH 12, if it's going to respond to some of the sodium, if the true pH, the true hydrogen ion activity is 12, true pH is 12, then, but it's responding a little bit to some of the sodium ions, then it will read something less than 12. It might read 11, but the true pH is 12. This is referred to as alkaline error. Okay, on the alkaline end of the scale, electrodes sometimes have problems dealing with huge disparities in concentrations. 10 billion is a lot. Okay? Big difference. And the ability of the electrode to distinguish hydrogen ions from sodium ions at that low of a hydrogen ion concentration and that high of a sodium ion concentration is asking a lot of the electrode. Now, if you bought a cheap electrode, forget it. Okay, if you went down to Middlesex Street, you know, got the guy with the raincoat, he opens up his raincoat, he's got a bunch of electrodes inside there, okay, he's got watches up here on this arm, but he's got electrodes over here. Okay, you bought that electrode, you know, all bets are off. It's not really going to respond very well up at pH 12. If you went to a Fisher Scientific catalog and flipped open the catalog and you know, looked at the several pages of pH electrodes that they have and bought a very expensive electrode, you could find one right there in the manufacturer's information description in the catalog. It'll tell you that it what range of pH, 0 to 12, 0 to 14, okay? It'll tell you what pH range it will respond correctly over, and it'll tell you, might even mention a little bit of something about alkaline error, okay? So this is the idea of alkaline error, and it's a little bit of a problem, something you need to know, right? Because you just say, oh, well, this is an electrode, a pH electrode. It measures hydrogen ion activity, and therefore, I want to measure hydrogen ion activity. I just happen to want to measure it way up at a high end of the scale, and I'll just use it. And people do that every day, and they, of course, make errors. And so you need to be aware of that. Now, what do I have? I have a blank screen here because I'm going to write something. There's a concept that I didn't put in my slides that I need to tell you about, and that concept is selectivity coefficients. Okay, you're writing this down. That's good. That's good. It'll help to keep you awake, too. Selectivity coefficients is the idea that if I have a sodium ion, like we just talked about, and to represent the electrode, I'm gonna call the electrode surface GL, okay? Glass. I know, not very imaginative, but I remember I described for you the silicon dioxide and the repeating, silicon oxygen silicon matrix, and at the edge of the matrix, where the matrix ends at the surface of the glass, there are silanol groups. Well, bear with me, and I'll call them GL minus groups, and they maybe have some hydrogen ions stuck to them. Okay, and there might be some groups that are GL minus with no hydrogen. Okay, it lost its hydrogen from the silanol group, and maybe a sodium can bind on there. So we have some kind of an equilibrium where sodium sticks to the site on the glass and kicks off the hydrogen. Okay, so I guess we could say where GL minus is a site on glass electrode. Okay, my handwriting's not that great. I actually failed handwriting in fourth grade. It's the only course I've ever failed. But at any rate, that there's an exchange that goes on between the sodium and the hydrogen on the glass. And remember, we've got 10 billion times the sodium concentration as we do a hydrogen ion. And so therefore, we see some of the sodium. This basically becomes our problem because the sodium attaches to the glass and responds, causes a response in the system. Now, we can write some kind of an equilibrium constant. So we'll call that K. Then we could call it K SEL for selectivity. I've seen them written as K with an EX, just to say exchange, some kind of an exchange. But the idea of all equilibrium constants is some kind of products over reactants. Well, how do I write the sodium GL minus? I don't know. I put it in little brackets. We know how to write hydrogen ion, molar concentration or activity of hydrogen ion. And let's see. So that's products. That's the right-hand side of the equation. Left-hand side is our hydrogen ion, GL minus, okay, and then sodium. All right? Now, if we took a chapter from the playbook that we use for other equilibria and how we handle those, we talk about an activity, a solid substance or a pure substance or a material that is not in solution having an activity of 1, and therefore we drop it out of our system. So let's drop these things out because we can't really know or write what their concentrations are very effectively. Our K turns out to be just a ratio of the two concentrations. And we said a minute ago that, in the system that I set up, this hydrogen ion might be 10 to the minus 12th, and the sodium might be 10 to the minus 2. And we got this gigantic number of 10 to the 10th. Actually, let's see. The difference between the two, or the relative, the ratio of the two is about 10 billion. Okay, so you can actually go to books or tables that tell you selectivity coefficients, and they might call it a KSEL or they might call it a KEX, that tells you something about the ability of a particular electrode material to selectively respond to one ion over the other. That's what a selectivity coefficient is all about when we're talking about potentiometry. It's just a means of saying this piece of glass, okay, that I used for this electrode is very selective for hydrogen ions. As a matter of fact, it's 10 billion times more selective for hydrogen ions than it is for sodium ions. But if you happen to have a lot of sodium in there, like 10 billion times more sodium, you'll see a response for the sodium. Okay, and that's what a selectivity coefficient is all about. And I wanted to introduce that concept, and I'm doing it using alkaline error. Okay, this idea that if we got lots of sodium, it's going to respond to sodium. This is true for all ions. Someone asked me after class last time, how do these electrodes, what are they responding to? Well, the fact of the matter is they'll probably respond slightly to almost any ion. Okay? But the key is they're selective for a particular ion. If it's a glass pH electrode, it's selective for hydrogen ions. In other words, its response for hydrogen ion, its selectivity coefficient for hydrogen ion is much, much better than it is for any other ion. Okay? And some ions, it will respond to a little bit more than others, but generally it's going to respond to the ion of interest, the analyte ion, greatest of all, and other ions it will respond to maybe a little bit. Okay, now this will become important later when we look at some data. You know, it's just so that you know that that is a concept and that's going on in the system. Okay, here's a little graph that shows you graphically the idea that we just talked about, the selectivity of the pH electrode for different things. What's plotted here, of course, is pH on the y-axis. On the x-axis, and on the y-axis is delta, the error in delta pH. In other words, I want to be here where there's no error, where the error is zero. That's where I want to be, okay? But having tested 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 electrodes, a few Corning electrodes, a couple of Beckman electrodes, and an LNN black dot, I have no idea what that is. But at any rate, if we tested these electrodes, somebody did, they tested them, and they said, well, in the pH range from about 1 up to 8 or so, no problem. The error is like essentially zero. There's no error. Okay? There's no error in the pH measurement, no appreciable error, again, on the scale that we're dealing with. Appreciable error. There are small errors, but there's no appreciable error here. However, when we get up into this high pH range, electrode C, the Corning 015 in 1 molar sodium solution. Now you say, well, gee, if I had 1 molar sodium hydroxide, the pH wouldn't be 10; it'd be 14. But it just says 1 molar sodium. They adjusted the pH up to 10 or so, and then they added a bunch of more sodium, as maybe sodium chloride or something. And what they found was the error started going crazy. Okay, they had an error as high as 1 pH unit by the time they got up to pH 12, we'll say. The case for electrode D wasn't much better, the Beckman. Okay. However, there were a couple of electrodes, E and F, okay, that did pretty well. They got up above pH 12. Electrode E, it looks like, gets almost to pH 14 with reasonable lack of error, we'll say. And then the error starts to take off. Okay. So it matters how the electrode is constructed. It matters how well designed and manufactured the electrode is. And again, if you go to the catalog, nobody goes to a catalog anymore, right? Everybody just clicks on the website for the company, and they go to the pH electrode page, and they find out, and again, in the description, usually they'll tell you this electrode will work at this pH range, and some of them will go to pH 14. Okay, some of them will, but you're going to pay a few hundred dollars probably for that good pH electrode. If you want the $50 electrode, I'm not even sure. I don't think you can get a pH electrode for $50 anymore. You used to be able to, but if you want the $50 or the cheapo electrode, you're going to have to bear with some of this problem, this alkaline error problem. Okay, Where there's alkaline error, there's acid error. And actually on that slide it showed acid error. There's some acid error down here at this end. Okay. Now, the acid error is not as bad. We're at pH 0 here. Okay. 0? You can have a pH of 0? Well, sure. 1 molar negative log of the hydrogen ion activity. If you have 1 molar acid, what's the log of 1? Well, anyway, that's a homework assignment. So acid error. So there's an error at the end, at the acid end as well. A little less easy for me to explain it. The best explanation I'll give to you is if you understand the concept of activity versus concentration, right? Crowding of ions, the ability or the inability of an ion to respond or to react the same way that it normally does in a dilute solution when it's crowded by lots of other ions around it. Okay, there's long-range dipolar interactions and, yeah.
On the previous slide, yeah? You meant the scale on the y-axis, but from -1 to -0.5 to 0 to -0.5.
Mm-hmm.
Is there supposed to be a positive somewhere in there?
Oh, I don't know. I just stole that from somebody. What's it say? Yeah, I don't know why it's negative on the on this end down here. I would assumed it would have assumed it would have been positive somewhere. It's just error, okay? The idea is it's error.
I think spending it's going more acidic side is getting negative acid means the pH getting negative. What if the pH is maybe 7? Then if we go in negative side means -1. Then
yeah, but it's delta pH. Okay, so it's
a -1 to.
It's the difference. It's the difference between the true reading and the actual reading. All right, the difference between what you see on the meter versus what the true pH should be based on the known amount of hydrogen ion that's in the particular system. So again, I took that out of a textbook to give you the concept. You get the concept, right? You get the concept. It's just a delta difference between the true and the measured pH, and there's a problem there. In the case of acid error, the theory or the our understanding of acid error is a little bit more difficult. But I'll explain it based on the concept of ions crowding around or ions competing for those active sites on the glass. There's a certain number of active sites on a piece of glass, all right? The spacing, you know, we could probably look that up and find out what the bond lengths are between silicon and oxygen and so forth. And we could determine that there's a certain number of active sites on the glass, and there's a pKa for the silanol group, and a certain number of those sites are deprotonated. So now we get to a case where we're in a highly acid solution. All of the available sites essentially are being protonated, and we're probably doubling up protons on individual sites. In other words, we've got layers. Essentially, the ions will arrange themselves in layers around the surface of the glass, and an ion that's directly attached to the active site should give it a response in our electrode. An ion that is next to an ion that's attached to an active site should not give us a response to the electrode, but it does. Okay, it gives us a little bit of a response in the system. And so we have a problem with the ability of the electrodes to accurately measure the hydrogen ion when the ions are extremely high in very high concentration. Okay, so suffice it to say that you just need to be aware that at the extremes of pH, these electrodes do not respond perfectly. Okay, there's an error that you need to be aware of. A couple of other things on errors in pH measurement number 4. You have the slide, so you know this doesn't go on forever. Okay, response time. Any potentiometric system responds in relation to the activity of the species of interest. If you're at high concentration, the response is pretty quick. It may be a few seconds. Okay, you stick a pH electrode into a pH 4 buffer, and you'll probably have a stable reading within 10 seconds. You stick a pH electrode in a pH 10 buffer, and it may take you a minute, 2 minutes for that reading to kind of stabilize out. Well, it's measuring hydrogen ions, and at pH 10, the hydrogen ion activity is 10 to the minus 10th. It's kind of having a little bit of time that it takes for it to equilibrate with those limited number of ions that are in the system. In the pH 4 case, it's 10 to the 4th molar hydrogen ion activity, and there's plenty of ions there, and everything is able to equilibrate quite rapidly. So response time is in relation to the activity of the species of interest, and you need to be aware of that because you have to allow your electrode sufficient time to respond if you want to get an accurate measurement. Okay? If you're measuring very, very high pH, very low hydrogen ion concentration, it's not unusual for it to take a little bit of time for that measurement to stabilize. And you say, I don't know what's wrong with this system. Nothing. Okay, nothing's wrong. It's just low concentration. Last on my list is the hydration of the glass surface. This glass surface is not hydrated. It's high and dry. Okay? We took it out of the... As a matter of fact, this electrode, as antique as it is, I found in a drawer when they were cleaning out the PCAM lab. It's probably never been used. Okay, but at any rate, in order for this to work properly, the glass surface needs to be hydrated. You need to stick it in solution and leave it there for a while for the glass surface, those little silanol groups that are sticking out into the solution, for them to become solvated or hydrogen, for water molecules to hydrogen bond to that surface. Right? Silanol, the surface of glass is very hydrophilic. It likes water. Right? It's OH. Of course it would like water. You know, chemistry, like, dissolves, like. And so water molecules will hydrogen bond to the surface of the glass, and the surface will change over time as it becomes hydrated. The dry surface is different than the hydrated surface. If the hydrated surface is different, then when I'm making a measurement with a dry electrode and sticking it into a solution, the surface is going to change, and the potential in my potentiometric system, my little electrochemical cell, is going to change until the surface of the glass equilibrates with the water molecules that are going to hydrate it. So a pH electrode should be kept wet or hydrated in order to work properly. If it dries out, it's not a big deal. You can rehydrate it, but if you try to make a measurement with it immediately, you will probably notice the electrode drifting. You will probably notice that I calibrated it to 7.00, 7.01, 7.02, 7.03. Hey, stop that. 7.03. You know, it's drifting a little bit because the surface of the glass is hydrating while you watch, okay, while you watch the response. So you need to be a little bit aware of that. I don't know if I have any, I don't have anything else. I do have a little bit here. Okay, glass membrane electrodes, very good indicator. Looks like great electrodes, really work well. Must exercise care and calibration. We talked about that. And also, I have two things listed here. Care and the calibration. Okay, so I told you how to do that. Then it says maintain the integrity of the glass membrane. Well, a little bit of the hydration business, that's the integrity of the glass membrane. The glass membrane has to be under the, you know, in the right form and under the right conditions to make the measurement correctly. I didn't bring a beaker with me this morning, but the favorite thing that students like to do is they like to stick their electrode into the beaker and grind the glass membrane into the bottom of the beaker, okay? And then, of course, then they drop it too hard and it breaks. But every time you drop this tip, every time you handle it, okay, don't handle it. Whatever you do, don't handle the electrode, okay? But you maybe scratch, put little scratches on the tip of this. Well, that's going to affect some of the active sites on the surface of the electrode. That may make the electrode even noisy. It may make it fluctuate a little bit on the pH reading because of scratches and surface defects on the surface of this glass membrane. So you have to be a little bit careful of this glass membrane. You know, best idea, don't ever touch it. Don't ever, you know, allow it to touch other surfaces. Keep it suspended from some kind of a little, you know, arm, little ring stand or something, and keep it hydrated, and everything will be fine. If you get it dirty and greasy, okay, like by rubbing your hands all over it, okay, don't do this at home, okay? Don't do this in the lab. Don't get your fingerprints all over the surface. Why? Because I'm getting oils from my fingers on the surface of the glass on those active sites where they need to respond. Although you can't see it, okay, they're there. Okay, that those oils are there, and they are blocking sites from being able to respond properly. You stick the electrode in a really dirty sample, you know, wastewater, okay, ucky stuff, wastewater, okay. Go down to the Lowell treatment plant. It even smells down there, okay. You can get an apartment right next to the wastewater treatment plant. It smells in those apartments. Yeah, low rent. They look nice, you know, nice brick buildings. It just stinks all the time. Okay, so I hope nobody lives there. But at any rate, if the surface of the electrode becomes coated with a oily material or anything that might bind to the glass or in any way affect the ability of those active sites to equilibrate with hydrogen ions, you got a problem in the response of the electrode. So you got to be thinking about how this works in order to get better measurements. All right, so that's what we're talking about here. Some errors mentioned are present. Some of those things are unavoidable. Asymmetry potential, you know, not much you can do about it. But as you are aware, some things you can do something about. Glass electrodes. Now here's the deal. Yes, go ahead.
You're not using your glass electrode. What kind of bucket should it be in?
Okay, manufacturers will tell you that for long-term storage, you can mix pH 7 buffer with just an ionic solution, you know, something like a sodium, you know, chloride solution or something like that, because it's good to keep it in a solution of ions. The best thing. Not so much, I'm jump ahead a little bit. The glass electrode, whether it's stored in distilled water or sodium chloride or buffer, not going to really do much to the glass, okay? It's not really going to permanently damage the glass. Okay, that's not, as long as you keep it hydrated and you keep it in some solution, it'll be fine. So that's not the problem. The problem is we have combination electrodes. This is a combination electrode, right? You don't really use an electrode like this. Nobody uses an electrode. This is an antique, right? It's probably worth money. I could probably get money for this on eBay. But what we really use is a combination electrode, which has a reference built in. The storage issue becomes one of the reference more than the actual glass membrane electrode. The reference electrode has a filling solution in it, and if you leave it, let's say you stick it in a let's stick it in your bottle of water up to here, okay? If the water starts to diffuse into the reference electrode filling solution, it will dilute it and cause the potential of the reference to change. That's a problem. So a lot of manufacturers recommend that you store the electrode in reference electrode filling solution for long-term storage. It's potassium chloride. Some of them will say mix buffer with potassium chloride. Partly that's just to dilute because saturated potassium chloride is messy, right? It keeps crystals growing in it, and it creeps out of the beaker. You know that? Whenever you're not looking, it's creeping out of the beaker. Okay. Am I being creepy? No. So the idea is you use a dilute solution so then it doesn't have the problem with crystals forming and creeping out of the beaker and ending up in the bottom. Okay? Does that answer your question? let's see. Okay, here's the deal. Make millions. How to make millions. Okay, how to make millions. You got to open your head, take your brain out, and wash it, maybe in some water. Okay, just clean it up a little bit because we tend to have misconceptions or thoughts, ideas that are incorrect. Here's an idea. You think like an entrepreneur, a millionaire. Okay, I got an electrode. I just found out that my electrode that I'm going to manufacture and sell is responding to sodium. Okay, it responds. It's supposed to be. I'm selling pH electrodes, and it responds a little bit to sodium. What am I going to do? We're going to call a meeting, get all the scientists together, and decide how we're going to fix this problem. But one person in the group says, "Fix the problem? I got an idea. Why don't we just make glass electrodes that respond to sodium? Scrap the whole pH idea and make electrodes that respond to sodium." Now, I'm being a little bit facetious. I'm always being a little facetious. But the idea is that somebody came up with this idea that the problem could be an answer to my retirement. Okay, an answer to how I can make more money. So all of a sudden, I send everybody back to the lab and I say, "Go back. Remember, I told you the glass is pretty much made, or is, I should say, selected empirically. They make glass and they find out, oh, this has some good properties. We'll use it as a pH electrode. We'll use it for pH electrodes." They didn't design the glass necessarily to measure, to respond to hydrogen ions. They just tested a whole bunch of different glasses and said, oh, this one works well for hydrogen ions. This one works really lousy for hydrogen ions, but guess what? It responds to sodium. So we'll make an electrode, a glass membrane electrode. Now remember, if you remember a couple of classes ago, I'm talking about membrane electrodes. I talked about electrodes of the first kind, electrodes of the second kind, and then I started talking about, you know, metallic and electrodes. Now I'm talking about membrane electrodes. So this is all under the general category of membrane electrodes. It turns out the glass membrane electrode, the first one that I've talked about, has taken a whole more than one lecture to cover. But that glass membrane electrode could be made to respond to other things, and that's what this is all about. So somebody said, we can make it to respond to other things, and we can charge exorbitant amounts of money for those electrodes also. All right? As a matter of fact, since it's a sodium electrode, they won't know. We'll charge double what we charge for the pH electrode. Okay? Well, and then we'll justify it by we mass produce the pH electrodes, but we hand make the sodium electrodes. I don't know. So if you buy a sodium glass membrane electrode from Fisher Scientific, it will look absolutely identical to a pH electrode. There is no difference. It is manufactured and constructed exactly the same way, with one exception. Two exceptions. One exception. The piece of glass that they used on the tip of the electrode, the part that responds, you know, the blue part, okay? It just happens to respond better to sodium than it does to hydrogen ion. It has a selectivity coefficient such that it's better to responding to sodium ions than it is to hydrogen ions. You look at it and you can't tell. Now, I said there were two differences. There is another difference. In the small print on the side of the electrode, it says sodium electrode. Okay, that's how you tell the difference. Because other than that, there's no difference. They look exactly the same. And you can't tell by looking at it that the glass membrane is what it responds to. There's just no way to tell by looking at it. You can look at it under a microscope, you still can't tell. You can look at it under an electron microscope, you still can't tell. Okay? It looks exactly the same. The only way you can do it is hook it up to a meter and test its response. So, you can make glass membrane electrodes for sodium. Well, because we had sodium error. Well, you can make one for potassium too, because do the same thing with potassium hydroxide, find out what glasses respond to potassium, and away you go. Turns out you can do it for ammonium ion and rubidium and cesium, and who cares? But somebody must, okay? And so lithium and silver works out its only cations. Why? Because silanol groups lose a hydrogen ion and they are negatively charged groups. So you need cations that are going to bind to those to that negatively charged site, okay? Combination electrodes, I mentioned already, but that's what everybody uses. It's two electrodes in one. Yes?
So if you keep the electron dry for a while, or if you don't use it,
yeah,
you're already losing all the protons from there. So going to be accept any cation anyway, right?
Well, you don't lose the protons, right? I mean, when a surface glass surface like that dries out, those protons are on there still, right? It has to maintain. You have to maintain electroneutrality somehow. Now, it'll be the internal solution is sealed inside the 0.1 molar. HCl is sealed inside. The outer surface of it will have some protons on it, you know, based upon the pKa or the last solution it was dipped into. And there may be some other ions that are just electrostatically attached, like a couple of sodium ions, and then some counter ions if there's not enough, if there's some extra stuff there that's not bound to a silanol site, then there might be a couple of chloride ions. When it comes right down to it, if you stop and think about it, Avogadro's number, okay, Avogadro's number, that's a big whopping number, okay? And so if you were, even if you have a very dilute solution, okay, you're going to have a few ions in there. There are going to be a few ions on there. So it dries out. The sites are largely probably filled with some ion, hydrogen ion, sodium, whatever was last in the solution was in. And but the water's the water molecules that hydrate the surface are largely gone. Now, you know, relative humidity in here today is kind of low, okay? But you put it in a 50% relative humidity and there's going to be some hydrogen. There's some water molecules on there. You get it on a really hot, muggy day in the summer, okay? You know, monsoon season, very hydrated, okay? Very hydrated on the surface. So, it's pretty complicated when you get right down to interfacial chemistry. It's pretty complicated. That's one of the reasons why we're still sort of figuring those things out. You know, chemists are still, we got a surface guy here, does a lot of, you know, electron microscope measurements, sort of pictures of surfaces, does X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy of surfaces to determine molecular, you know, configuration, what's on the surface. You know that when you take a piece of glass like this, no carbon involved, you put that in an XPS instrument, an X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy instrument, an instrument that will tell you what molecules, what atoms are on the surface, you always find carbon. You always find carbon. It's always there. Now, where does it come from? Well, some of it's from probably adsorbed carbon dioxide, but some of it, and so they say, okay, we'll get rid of that. You know, we'll put it under a high vacuum, and of course you have to do that anyway. But we'll get rid of the carbon dioxide. There's always a little bit of carbon contamination because carbon is everywhere. Actually, I'm made mostly of carbon. Okay. Anybody, does that answer your question a little bit? Okay. All right. So if you want to look at this, the combination electrode is, there's a central glass tube that has a silver wire going through it all the way down to the tip. So if you look at this, and it's kind of a little dirty inside. I didn't wash the inside of the electrode out. But there's the inner electrode is the glass pH electrode. So there's an inner tube that goes all the way down with a wire in it to the tip. Then there's an outer tube that has another silver wire in it with a big blob at the end of the silver wire. What's that? That's the silver chloride. Okay? And you fill that outer solution through this little hole in the side of the electrode. Where's the hole? There it is. And then there's a porous junction on the side, a little dimple on the side, a ceramic. Usually that's a ceramic. I can't really tell by scratching it. But it's probably a ceramic junction. It could be it can be fiber junctions, but nobody uses those anymore. They grow bacteria. Everything grows bacteria. But even the ceramic will grow a little. And you remember when we talked, I said before, 99.9% of the time, if you have a problem with a measurement, it's not the glass electrode, it's not the meter, it's probably that porous junction on the side there is clogged up with something. It may be clogged up with silver chloride or potassium chloride crystals, either one, silver chloride or potassium chloride, could clog that up. Or there may be some microorganism living in, you know, growing on the outside of the thing because you haven't used your electrode or cleaned it off or whatever in months, all right? And as a matter of fact, you go back to the lab and you find it, the solution has evaporated down to here and the electrode's hanging right here. It's all dried out. But the problem is usually with the reference electrode. That's usually where we have problems when we make measurements in potentiometry. Okay, what else do we have here? Hello? Oh, there's a picture of the combination electrode. There it is, a diagram. So two connections. This has a BNC connector on it. These are what you call American standard. There's just one connector, okay, just one contact point. And you need the reference electrode separately, and you put the two of them in solution, and you got an electrochemical cell for measuring pH. This one has a BNC connector on it. It has a central contact and an outer contact. One's for the reference. One, the central one is for the indicator, which is the pH. The outer one is for the reference. Everybody's probably seen this, but you can pass it around if you want. So it's two connections, all right, to the pH meter. Then it says air inlet, but this is also where you put in the filling solution. Okay, talks about the AG paste. You can see there's a wire hanging in there with the silver paste on it, and glass membrane, porous plug. Okay, solution is leaking out of the porous junction all the time. As a matter of fact, manufacturers rate the leakage rate. They rate the leakage? Yeah, I guess they do. Okay, they actually talk about, this electrode, this junction will leak solution at so many nanoliters per hour. Okay, that's a really small amount. But solution has to be able to pass through there, right? Because in order for there to be act as a salt bridge for ion mobility in the system, and so that's necessary. And there's all sorts of, I mentioned to you Vicor glass, which is borosilicate with the boron etched out. That's a one way of doing it. Then there's ceramic, where we make if you've ever used a fritted glass filter in a laboratory, that kind of a very fine ceramic, a Gooch, you know what a Gooch crucible is? Nobody knows what this stuff is anymore. It's all lost in the, but it was, I'm doing undergraduate quantitative analysis, and they use crucibles that you can filter through. A Gooch crucible has a porous ceramic, like a fritted filter in the bottom of it. And that's what that is. That's like a ceramic, a porous ceramic. And then you can use fiber. Okay, you can use fiber. You can use gels. Well, gels are porous, right? You know, you make a gel with large enough spacing, and so you can buy gel electrodes. Those are like the greatest medium for bacteria to grow ever. Okay, anyway. So that's one of the problems that you have with those electrodes. Is it has to leak. It has to have a porous junction. And organisms or other things can get in there and plug it up. All right. That's all I'm going to say about glass electrodes, glass membrane electrodes. But we're still talking about membrane electrodes. We're going to talk about some other kinds of membrane electrodes. The next kind we're going to talk about is the liquid membrane electrode. A liquid membrane is a funny thing, because we can't even think of how a liquid membrane might work. The example I'm going to give you is the calcium electrode. I brought another antique calcium electrode because, if I brought the nice good ones, you guys, they'd kind of get wrecked. So we bring the old cruddy ones to class to play with. But they get the point across. It's kind of big. The new ones are smaller and more sleek in design. Okay, the 2006 models, they'll be available. Okay, zero APR financing. So calcium electrode is a liquid membrane electrode. It's based on the same principle, and all these electrodes are going to be based on a similar principle as we've seen before. It's a silver wire, we've seen that before, with a silver chloride coating on the end of it. However, the filling solution that's in equilibrium with that silver chloride coating is calcium chloride, okay, and it says filling solution, a fixed calcium chloride solution, just like we had a fixed hydrogen ion solution, the HCl in the last one, we now have a fixed calcium chloride solution inside of this membrane, electrode. Now, at the bottom, so that's all standard stuff. The only thing different is the calcium is in the filling solution. A lot of times that's sealed. In this particular one, it's not sealed. You actually have to unscrew the electrode and fill it with the calcium filling solution. And there's two ports on the top here, one for the inner solution and one for the outer solution. And so the idea is, and they give you little syringes, you know, and a bottle. So you fill the one solution, then you fill the other solution. Okay. Now what's the other solution? The other solution is this outer reservoir that's filled with an ion exchanger that is the actual, what we call the liquid membrane. The way it works is I have a membrane in the bottom of the electrode. The membrane is a teensy-weensy little membrane that's contained in this little... Here's one. Stuck on the side of the... I'll never get it. The membranes are in here. They're little tiny circles, okay? They go inside of this tip, and they screw on the end, okay? So that there's a little tiny, couple of millimeter diameter exposed piece of membrane. The membrane, but that's not liquid. Where's the liquid come from? The liquid is this filling solution. It's an ion exchanger that soaks into that membrane. Okay? And so the actual membrane that we're concerned about is this liquid ion exchanger. Okay, so it's a water immiscible organic compound with phosphate groups. Why phosphate groups? Because phosphate groups bind calcium ions. Okay, phosphate groups have an affinity for calcium ions. So we get the organic chemists. We knew this from inorganic chemistry. Calcium phosphate is an insoluble material. But we get the organic chemists to build us a organic compound with phosphate groups on it. And so the phosphate groups are selective for calcium. They're in a, it's a water immiscible material, so it doesn't wash away. I put it in my filling solution. It soaks into my membrane at the surface, and now I have a membrane that, remember, like the glass, how I described the glass? It's a thin piece of glass, and it's got functional groups on both sides. On one side, those functional groups are in contact with the fixed hydrogen ion solution. Well, on this side, on this electrode, the liquid ion exchanger, that water immiscible ion exchanger, on one side, it's in contact with the fixed calcium ion solution in here. And on the other side, it's in contact with your test solution. And because they have a molecular structure, because everything's made, you know, of chemicals, right? Then anything that happens on the outside influences what happens on the inside. So I put a lot of calcium ions on the outside. They bind to that liquid, that thin layer of ion exchanger soaked into that little membrane. The calcium binds to that. That influences the calcium bound on the inside, maybe causes it to release some calcium on the inside. That influences the internal filling solution and the potential of our silver-silver chloride system, and we get a response. I dip it into a low calcium concentration. All the calcium comes off the surface of the electrode, of that liquid membrane that's out here. That influences the calcium on the inside. More calcium binds, maybe to compensate for that. And we see a change in the internal solution, and we get a response at our electrode. And that's how they work. Okay? The key item... Obviously, it's all important, it's all necessary to make the electrode work, but the thing that is specific for calcium is this water-immiscible organic compound, and we can make different ones. So if you went out and found several manufacturers that were making these types of electrodes, you might find that the chemistry of their water-immiscible organic compound is a little bit different in each manufacturer. You know, they've got their own proprietary stuff. Okay, and so that's how this works. And this is, when you buy it, you get a kit like this that has the electrode, which comes apart, and little membranes to put in there, and filling solutions. These filling solutions are disgusting. Okay, they're probably old and smelly and don't work anymore. But don't open the tubes, and it will all be very happy. Okay, so you can take a look at that. So that's how a liquid membrane electrode works. What can I say? Principle is the same as a glass electrode. However, calcium is a divalent ion, so N is equal to 2 in the Nernst equation. The slope of the calibration curve is 29.5, whatever, you know, half of the 59 that we talked about before from the Nernst equation, 0.0591, half of that. Okay? So every time we change the concentration by a factor of 10, every tenfold change, so it's a log linear calibration, right? It's log concentration, whatever the species is, versus volts or millivolts, okay? And depending on the ion, we may get a positive slope or a negative slope. Positive slope, negative slope, okay? Positive ions, negative ions. And depends on how the system is set up. And in the case of, let's see, slope is Nernstian, intercept, K. So we talked about K in the pH electrode case. We talked about E0 when we talked about defined electrochemical systems. This would be one of those systems, again, where you have a K, because we're not dealing with a defined chemical reaction that we know an E0 for. We're dealing with calcium binding to some unknown water immiscible polymer. Somebody knows what it is, but we don't know what it is. So we don't worry about it. We just calibrate with standards, just like we did in the pH case. We calibrate with calcium standards, and then we make our measurements in our test solutions. The better the standards match the test solution, the better the results are probably going to be. All right. And that's generally the case in analytical chemistry. Selectivity, right? We had selectivity coefficients. Same is true here. The selectivity happens to be independent of pH from pH 5.5 to 11. Above pH 11, what do I have? Other ions in the system that are going to cause problems. Sodium ions that may respond, that may attach to the... Oh, I don't have it here anymore. That may bind to that water immiscible ion exchanger. Below pH 5.5, I'm going to find hydrogen ions are going to get into the mix and cause me trouble. So between 5.5 and 11, I'm fine. Can I make measurements then? I can't make any measurements above 11 or below 5.5? Not really. You can make measurements above there, above 11 or below 5.5. It's just that they become dependent on pH. The measurement that you get is independent of pH between 5.5 and 11. It doesn't matter what the pH is, the measurement will be the same. Above 11, below 5.5, if I change the pH, I'll see a change in the response. So if I was at pH 4, if everything that I do is exactly at pH 4, that's okay. As long as the pH is fixed. If I'm changing, sometimes it's 4, sometimes it's 5, sometimes it's 3.5, 4.5, if this pH of my solutions is varying, that's going to influence the potential I get, and I'm going to get garbage for results. Okay, so that's what this is talking about here. The response of my electrode is 50 times better for calcium than it is for magnesium. Okay, 50 times better selectivity. It's 50 times better. The calcium electrode is 50 times better for calcium than it is for magnesium. It's 1,000 times better for calcium than it is for sodium or potassium. Well, that's good. That's good, 1,000 times better. And there are many different kinds of membrane electrodes available. I'll show you some in a minute. Here's that little plot of activity or concentration of calcium. That's a log scale. Here is a linear scale of millivolts, and there's that slope, the Nernstian slope, because N is equal to 2. It does respond to activity, as all electrodes do, and it's not concentration. So they show you, here's what it looks like with activity, here's what it looks like with concentration. And so you need to be aware, it's log, this is a log scale, it's activity, not concentration, and then it's linear on this axis. Okay, so if I asked you on an exam to draw the response of an electrode, you would write a plot like this, and you would have to tell us, where does this slope come from? Well, it comes from, you know, RT over NF in the Nernst equation, and its intercept is related to some K factor that we don't know about that is specific for the particular system that we have. And then so it responds, works like everything else, works like all of these other electrodes. Okay, here is a table. You can just barely see this. Something wrong with this projector, so things get cut off over here. But calcium gives you the concentration range. As low as 5 times 10 to the minus 7th molar. That's pretty low. That's down in the micromolar concentration range. Okay, micromolar concentration range is good. Look at all those interferences. Okay, look at all those interferences that are listed here. Okay, what does this mean? This means that, well, lead is a problem at 10 to the minus 5th molar. Mercury is a problem with this electrode if I have that present in the solution. Hydrogen ion can be a problem also. All these different ions, and even tris buffer, can be a problem with this electrode. Again, if it's constant in all of your samples, you may get by with it. If it varies in your solution, as does your analyte, you may not be able to use the electrode. It just might not work for you. Okay. You can make an electrode for BF4 minus, okay? Boron tetrafluoride. Who cares? I guess somebody cares. Somebody cares. Okay, somebody wants to do boron tetrafluoride. You can get a nitrate electrode. Nitrate's good because there aren't a lot of good ways to measure nitrate. Okay, nitrate's kind of one of those difficult things to measure, and so it's good to have a nitrate electrode. Perchlorate, okay. Potassium, why bother? Okay, there's other ways to measure potassium, like the glass electrode. You can buy a water hardness electrode that responds to both calcium and magnesium. So you get two measurements, the sum of two measurements in one. They just got an ion exchanger in there that responds essentially the same to calcium and magnesium, and therefore gives you that kind of a response. Okay, so we got to be aware what's available in liquid membrane electrodes, what their concentration range is for it to be useful to you, and then what interferences there might be. Okay, it looks like a lot of things. Well, yeah, it kind of is a lot of things, but maybe that's not a problem. Maybe it is a problem. All right. Okay, solid-state membrane electrodes. Solid-state membrane electrodes are important. Very important and very good electrodes, okay? These are very good electrodes, and let me just check something for a moment here. Okay, I got a problem here. I got a small problem with my battery. It's critical. It's a critical problem with my battery.